Western civilization. It's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, we'll ask that you do not call in this evening unless we specifically ask you to call, because we have a special guest this evening. His name is Dr. George Fletcher, and we're going to be talking about, of all things, iodine deficiency. Now, that may seem to be a rather obscure subject to talk about when so much is going on in the world, from the spiritual point of view, from the political point of view, from the military point of view, and all the problems we have in the Middle East, and yes, the very real problems we have in America. But I think that as this program progresses, you'll find out that this is also a very significant issue. And it's something that most of us really don't think about. I mean, after all, iodine deficiency, that was something that, well, it used to exist in America a long time ago. But fortunately, we have excellent public health service, and what it was found that many people in the basin around the Great Lakes had goiters many years ago. They started iodizing our salt, and that really sort of ended the problem. Of course, we used to get a certain amount of iodine out of fish, but we're told not to eat much fish because of the danger of mercury intoxication, mercury poisoning. The one time, of course, when I used to work in the hospitals, every Friday they had fish. Most of the hospitals were Catholic, and that was the Catholic tradition, but that changed. So a lot of people aren't eating a lot of fish today. But is iodine really a factor in health? Well, with us this evening, as I said, is Dr. George Fletcher. And I heard a two-hour talk he gave. Somebody sent it to us. And I was so intrigued by that, I asked him to come onto the program this evening, because I am firmly convinced, not only about what he said, but I went to my other experts and asked them, could this possibly be true? And they assured me he was right on in everything he said. So I can hardly wait to have you hear what he has to say. Good evening, Dr. Fletcher. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you just pick up the story and tell us how you got involved in this whole incredible story.
Well, back towards the late part of the 1900s, about 1999, 1998, right in there, there was an article in the Journal for the American Medical Association where they were talking about different diseases that were on the rise, and one of them was an illness known as fibrocystic breast disease. And they were talking about how more and more American women had this particular problem. By the early 1990s, approximately 84% of women in North America had problems with cyclic breast pain with their periods. Some women lived with the breast pain constantly. I mean, I've had women come in and tell me that the breast pain was so bad it felt like two major big thorns in their chest, and they were living with this pain all the time, 24 hours a day. And in that article, they pointed out that the main disease, the main source of this was felt to be a iodine deficiency. And I had been trained, as probably you were, that iodine deficiency manifested as goiter. And I didn't see how in the world could iodine deficiency be related to fibrocystic breast disease or this problem of cyclic breast pain. And so it pushed me and some fellow colleagues of GYN endocrinologists by the name of Dr. Guy Abraham out of Torrance, California, to start looking at different articles and start trying to pick out what is the relationship between iodine deficiency and problems with fibrocystic disease.
Hold that thought right there. All right, go ahead. Pick the story up there.
So what ended up happening is that we started investigating, and what we found was that iodine deficiency in the thyroid manifest as cyst, nodule, scar tissue enlargement, and we call that goiter. And iodine deficiency in the breast manifest as cyst, nodules, scar tissue, enlargement, tenderness, and we call that fibrocystic breast disease. And the lack of iodine in the ovary manifests as cyst, nodules, scar tissue, enlargement, and that we call polycystic ovarian syndrome. It turns out that many years ago, especially in the Great Lakes region, prior to 1924, and even today, that they had discovered that people who have goiter had a higher rate of breast cancer, esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, ovarian cancer, and cancer of the uterus, known as endometrial cancer. So that we started looking into what, and this was something that had been shown in Switzerland and something that had been shown up in the Piedmont area of Italy and so on. And it turns out that it's the absence of iodine in these tissues that causes the tissues to promote the development of cancer. So that we became more and more interested in this because, as you can see, the rise cancer, like let's say breast cancer, back in 1959, one out of every 17 women in North America had problems with breast cancer. And today it's one out of every eight, and within another few years it's one out of every seven. And what's interesting is that we keep looking nationwide at what is it that we're doing to the breast to induce these problems of breast cancer. And a lot of times it's not what we're doing as much as what we're not doing. What's happening is that we are not stimulating the tissues with the use of iodine. It turns out that there are enzymes in the breast, enzymes in the thyroid, enzymes in the bone marrow that help to absorb the body, helps the body to absorb iodine.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Fletcher was simply saying that his interest was piqued by reading this article back in the late 1980s, talking about how there was an epidemic of fibrocystic disease in women, and it was an increasing problem, and it was related to iodine. So he and his cohorts began to investigate this, and they found that there was not only a relationship of thyroid deficiency to goiter, but also to a fibrocystic breast disease. And with the increase of fibrocystic breast disease to just a fraction, 1 or 2, maybe 5% of women up to 89, pushing on at least well over 85, sometimes 89% of women now have fibrocystic disease, and they never used to have it. And then similar problems as far as the ovary, as far as the uterus was concerned. And an marked increase in cancer of the breast, almost double here in the last 30 years, and nobody can figure out why this is happening. And then, of course, as they began analyzing what was going on, they found out that iodine tends to protect the breast from cancer. So you picked the story up there.
What we discovered is that, the lack of iodine, especially in the breast tissue, manifests as fibrocystic breast disease, and then in the New England Journal of Medicine, July 24 issue of 2005, they mentioned that there was a definite increase in risk of development of breast cancer in women with fibrocystic breast disease. Now, up until this time, we've called it fibrocystic breast disease, but within the last few years, radiologists, pathologists, many different types of doctors have now changed the terminology, and they call it benign breast changes. And the problem is that benign breast changes may be what it's called now, but let that type of problem sit inside the breast tissue for 20 or 30 years, and the risk of breast cancer starts climbing. So, and in fact, here in North Carolina, the number one reason that radiologists get sued for abnormal mammograms is the fact that they missed a breast cancer in a patient with fibrocystic breast disease. So this is a pretty serious problem, and it's one that can be easily addressed by giving patients iodine.
Well, I thought it was so interesting. You were commenting that basically back when we used to have hypothyroidism and goiter, which was endemic in the Great Lakes area, that there was a much higher incidence of at least those people who were with hypothyroid of breast cancer and these other uterine and ovarian cancers. Is that right?
That's true. In fact, back there have been studies that have been done showing that in all these cities, counties, states along the Great Lakes region who have the highest rates of hypothyroidism also are the cities, counties, and states that had the highest rates of breast cancer. And there seems to be a very high correlation between the two. What's also interesting is that in the Journal for the American Medical Association in 1976, there was a very really interesting article where they showed that if the rate of breast cancer in the United States is like 6%, that the day you put a woman on thyroid hormone to help the body to, you know, to for treatment of hypothyroidism, that the day you put a woman on thyroid hormone, you literally double her risk of development of breast cancer. So we go from a 6% rate to a rate of around 12%. If a woman has been taking thyroid hormone for greater than 15 years, her risk of breast cancer is something like 19.6%. If a woman has been taking thyroid hormone for greater than 15 years and she's never had a child before, her rate of breast cancer is up at around 33%. And we, since then, have tried to study this out, and what we finally discovered was is that when you take supplemental thyroid hormone, you literally inhibit the ability of the body to absorb iodine. And in fact, I, as a family practice doctor, have found patients where we found a thyroid mass or a nodule, big nodule, and we needed to do a I-123 uptake and scan. It's a radioactive iodine study with the use of iodine, and the nuclear medicine department at the local hospital will sit there and tell you that you need to take the patient off of thyroid hormone for at least 2 to 3 weeks so that they can do their study, because when you put somebody on thyroid hormone, you inhibit the ability of the thyroid to absorb iodine, especially radioactive iodine, because that's how you can tell if these nodules or masses that you find in the thyroid are either a cancer or a non-cancer and so on. So it's been pretty much proven at this point that women that take thyroid supplementation of hormone are actually at much, much higher risk for development of breast cancer.
You know, one of the things that really disturbs me is that so many people in America today are being put on thyroid hormone. They're being put on thyroid, the Armour's thyroid. And when I was going to medical school, hypothyroidism existed, but it was not almost like it's endemic now, like an epidemic of hypothyroidism, and everybody's got to take it. They do a blood test. They say, look, while your numbers are down, we got to put you on thyroid hormone because we want to help you.
In fact, one of the top pharmaceutical drugs sold in the United States is thyroid hormone, and it's become number one. It surpassed the sales of Tagamet and Xanax and everything else because the problem of hypothyroidism nationwide is just, grown exponentially.
But nobody ever asks, why has it grown exponentially? That's the question.
That's true.
And we're going to tell them that. I know you're going to tell them. Go ahead.
Yeah, it turns out that in the American diet, let's go back to prior to 1924. We look at cities like Akron, Ohio. 56% of the people in Akron had goiters. The same thing could be true for a lot of the cities along the Great Lakes region. We can talk about Buffalo. We can talk about Milwaukee. We can talk about Chicago, Detroit. All of these big cities had major, major problems with goiter. Now, it's interesting that in the original studies done by Dr. Marine in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Marine showed that the incidence of goiter among children was 1-to-1, one boy, one girl. But as soon as the girls went through puberty, the incidence of goiter went up, and so we now find that there was 6 girls to every one boy having problems with goiter. And it would be back in the 1960s and 70s when we would discover that breast tissue utilizes and uses as much iodine, or if not more, than the thyroid. And so when you have iodine coming into the body, the breast tissue is competing with the thyroid as to who's going to get the iodine. Now, the thyroid itself is only like about 8.3 cc's big, but each breast is somewhere between, let's say, 100 to 200 cc's for each tissue. And in some women, as you've seen, they can get pretty big. So we can talk about breast tissue in women being anywhere from 200 to 800 or 900 or even 1,000 cc's of tissue as compared to the thyroid, which is 8.3. So as you can see, you know, the development of breast tissue competes with the thyroid as far as who's going to get the iodine.
And really, isn't the iodine essential for normal health of the breast?
That's right. And, you know, back in 1924, Dr. Marine gave a bunch of patients, a group of children, iodine, and he, at that time, gave about 9 milligrams a day to inhibit the development of goiter. And he was able to demonstrate that it worked. And soon after that, the United States government decided to start putting iodine in the salt, and we iodized the salt, and by 1928-29, goiter was on a definite decrease nationwide. Now, what's interesting is the RDA that was developed at that time, the RDA was looking at how much iodine can you give a person that inhibit the development of goiter, because that's the only thing that they could associate with iodine. And it would be years later when we would find out that the thyroid gland itself only holds about 3% of all the iodine in the human body. 70% of all the iodine in the body sits inside the muscles and fat. 20% sits inside the skin. And the tissue that has the highest ability to concentrate iodine above and beyond the thyroid is that of the ovary. And it turns out that lack of iodine to the ovary gives you an ovary that starts malfunctioning and gives you a tremendous amount of trouble. So that you can see where it's so important to get the iodine into the ovaries, because that's what helps them out. Now, as we've already discussed, the absence of iodine in the ovary can give you problems with a lot of recurrent cysts. And there's a dangerous problem out there called polycystic ovarian syndrome, where women develop multiple cysts of the ovaries, but one of the biggest problems they have is infertility. And in my medical practice, we've had probably 5 women who have come in now that have had problems with polycystic ovaries. And once we put them on iodine, the patients started having periods. Usually these women have periods maybe once a year, maybe once every 9 months. And within 6 months, these women were all having periods every 28 days.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Go ahead, please.
With the use of the iodine, what ended up happening is these women started having periods every 28 days. And one of the problems with women with polycystic ovaries is a problem of infertility. And we've now had a total of 4 out of the 5 women who have all become pregnant and have delivered healthy babies. One of the things that we have picked up on is, this was just published like two or three years ago, is that the absence of iodine in early pregnancy is felt, and we're talking within the first two or three months of getting pregnant, that the absence of iodine in early pregnancy is a reason why children go on to develop problems with attention deficit disorder. It does not seem to be any relationship between thyroid hormone levels and TSH blood levels at the time of birth with ADD, but there is the lack of iodine in early pregnancy that's felt to be a source of this problem. This was actually worked up in Italy, where they had areas of it. There are certain areas of Italy where there's problems with not enough iodine in the soil and in the water and the food and so on. And children, there was something like 20 children being followed in one little community, in certain communities, and over a 10-year time period, something like 11 out of the 20 children developed ADD. And in communities where there was lots of iodine in the water, the soil, the food, and so on, the children that were being followed in those communities, 0 out of 20 children developed problems with attention deficit disorder. So the rate was very high in those areas where there wasn't any iodine. And it turns out that iodine in early pregnancy, and in fact throughout the whole pregnancy, determines the IQ of a child. And in fact, most neurobiologists and neurophysiologists and other people have been able to sit there and say that iodine is what sets the person's IQ. In other words, a baby's IQ is pretty much set in concrete by the time the baby is 2 years old. And iodine throughout a pregnancy and iodine throughout the first 2 years of life will pretty much will help to increase a child's IQ by at least about 15 points. And we've seen this with our with the babies in our practice. We've seen where babies at 3 and 4 months old, we were able to teach these children how to do a high five, worked with them for about 5 or 6 minutes, then we stepped away and went and did something else, and then came back about 10 minutes later and put the hand up for the baby to do a high five, and that kid just took its hand and put it right up just as if it knew what it was supposed to do. So IQ can be influenced by the amount of iodine in early pregnancy and also in early childhood.
Well, I think that's really fascinating. And there's so many other places where the iodine is important in development. So you go right ahead.
Well we've we've looked at, there was an interesting study in the sense of, this was just published a few years ago, but throughout the world, like in India and China and other places, there are committees who are set up to monitor the level of iodine in the population.
You go right ahead there. Okay, fine. So the Indian and China and other areas of where they actually have committees that are monitoring the iodine, and what did they find?
Well, what they found was is that there was an interesting study that was published in China, where they had a community where there was very little iodine in the community, and the Chinese government decided to introduce the concept of fluoridation of the water, fluoridating the water. When they started putting fluoride in the water, and in communities where the iodine levels in the community were known to be marginal, all of a sudden the pregnant women in these communities started spitting up babies that were literally what you and I in the medical profession know as cretins. And for most people out there, it just means that these babies were very mentally retarded.
And they're very small, too, as I remember.
Yes. And it turns out that these that just fluoridating the water, in a community where there was very little iodine, gave them problems with mentally retarded children.
And, of course, certainly the fluoride competes with the iodine to get into the thyroid, and if you have very little iodine anyway, and then you put the fluoride on top of it, the iodine isn't getting into the thyroid at all, is it?
That's correct. And so, now, having said that, let's look at what's happened here in America. In America, we used to put iodine in bread. In fact, one slice of bread back in the 1960s, you could get a slice of bread and it'd have 160 micrograms of iodine per slice of bread. And somewhere along the way, somebody decided to take the iodine out of the bread and substitute in there another product called bromide. And we'll have to get to that later. And then we used to put iodine in the milk. We used to use iodine to help sterilize the tits of cows so that we could milk them and the iodine would get into our milk. And now they've totally taken the iodine out of the milk and they're using some other chemicals. And then we have this putting iodine in the salt. Now what's interesting is that if you do studies on salt, you'll find out that 50% of American women cook with salt that has no iodine in it.
I don't think that the average woman really realizes that they've taken the iodine out of the salt. I mean, my wife, really wasn't aware of this until she went down and started looking for salt and looking to see if it had iodine, and she had to look through several different brands to find one that had iodine in it. Why would they have taken the iodine out of the salt when it's so essential to their health, the people?
Yeah, it's. I think what happens is that it's about a 50. About 50% of all the salt that's out there has got iodine in there, and why it's being taken out, I have no idea. What we do know is that, in fact, I just got this. This was in a medical journal for family practice doctors. In fact, also. It was also reported in the Journal for the American Medical Association in one of their newspapers. But in there, it sat there and said that the American Medical Association is going to recommend to all physicians in North America that we try to cut by 50% the amount of salt intake for Americans over the next 10 years. Well, if you take the iodine out of the bread and you take the iodine out of the milk and the only iodine most people get is through the salt and we reduce that by another 50%, what are we going to do? We're going to make this epidemic of hypothyroidism nationwide even worse because you need iodine to be able to make thyroid hormone. If you don't have iodine, you don't make the hormone. And what ends up happening is that as those of us that are getting into our 50s and beyond, and the blood pressure starts going up, the first thing the doctor wants to do is cut back on your salt because if you have too much salt, you're going to increase your blood pressure. And what happens is that if you look at the population at age 60 and above, almost 25 to 30% of the people who become senile beyond age 60 are senile due to lack of thyroid hormone secondary to the presence of no iodine in their diet. And a lot of it is because we're taking the salt away from them because of, quote, hypertension.
And we're telling them not to eat the fish because there's mercury in it. Oh, we're from the government. We're here to help you. We're going to be back in just a moment with George Fletcher. And this is really incredible. I had never heard this until recently. We've checked it out. It's accurate. They've taken the iodine out of the bread. They've taken it out of the milk. They've taken it out of half of the salt. They're telling you not to eat salt and... We'll be back in just a moment. Well, you go right ahead with the story.
Well, it's interesting. They took the iodine out of our bread, and they use. Iodine and bromide and fluoride are all what they call halogens, and especially bromide and iodine are what they are halogens or halides that are used in the bread industry to help you have beautiful looking loaves of bread. If you've ever tried to make bread, homemade bread, you'll notice that your homemade bread has, when it cools down, it usually the crust gets kind of hard and it separates from the top and so on. But professional bread makers will take and put these halogens, such as bromide or iodine, into the bread, and it gives you these beautiful looking loaves of bread where the top of the bread hangs on in there. And it turns out that by the 60s and 70s, they took the iodine out of bread and they started using bromide. And let me just give you a little bit of a history here. Back in the 1800s, we had here in Asheville, North Carolina, a place called the Grove Park Inn. And Dr. Grove was a physician who used to take bromide and attach it to quinine, and it was a product called bromoquinine, and he used it as a chemical to, quote, fatten up your children. And in fact, for those of you who want to go to the Grove Park Inn in Asheville, North Carolina, and you will see pictures of children, human children, on the body of a pig. And you can see it on the bottles that were sold by Dr. Grove back in that time period. And it was pictures that were, and this was a, the rationale for using this product was to try to, quote, fatten up your children, since back then it was felt that a fat child was better than a skinny one. Well, it turns out that by the 1920s, we have a new product out on the market called Bromo Seltzer. And Bromo Seltzer, for those people who like to imbibe an alcohol, they would wake up in the morning with a really bad headache, and they would use Bromo Seltzer to help calm down their stomachs and their headaches and so on. Well, it turns out that if you used too much Bromo Seltzer, bromide builds up inside the central nervous system, and it was causing problems with paranoid schizophrenia.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Dr. Fletcher has been telling us that, you know, they've taken the bromide out of the bread, pardon me, the iodine out of the bread, and replaced it with a bromide substance, which is a halogen. But the significant thing is that certainly bromide is a very toxic substance. And there was a time, and I'm old enough to remember when they had something called Bromo Seltzer, which you took for a headache or for a hangover. And of course, I didn't take it for a headache or a hangover, but this was used many, many years ago. And then they found out that many of these people were getting paranoid. Was that right?
That's right. In fact, if you can go to any medical dictionary and look up the word bromomania. And bromomania is a description of patients who develop a psychosis secondary to the presence of bromide in their body.
And so we're putting this into our bread, into our loaves of bread regularly.
Yeah, yeah. So back between and this is, you know, statistics that come straight out of the New England Journal of Medicine, but between 1920 and 1960, over 20% of the people admitted to American psychiatric hospitals were being admitted for problems with acute paranoid psychosis secondary to taking Bromo Seltzer. In fact, you might be old enough to remember back probably in the 50s and 40s admitting a patient who might have been having problems with DTs or having undergone withdrawal off of alcohol, and they would be having problems with DTs, and they would be thrown into the psych unit, and the doctors back then would sit there and say, well, we don't know if the DTs this person is having is because of coming off of alcohol, or is it because they've been drinking too much bromide. And I've talked to physicians who have practiced back in those days, and they told me that that was exactly what the thinking was among physicians. It turns out that by 1964, the FDA is getting concerned about the effects of bromide on newborn babies and what bromide was doing to these children and so on. And but it's interesting that all of a sudden a new product came out on the market that was loaded with bromide. This product was called Mountain Dew. And if you'll look on the side of the bottle of Mountain Dew, it says brominated vegetable oil. They use bromide to mix with oil, and then the bromide helps to disperse the citric acid oil that they put into the Mountain Dew to give it that citrus flavor. Well, Mountain Dew is not the only one. They've been doing this with Fresca. They've been doing it with a tremendous number of soft drinks. They've also been doing the bromide into the Gatorade products that contain citrus, the citric acid, to give it that citrus flavor. And just to give you an interesting story, one of my kids in my medical practice, a teenager, was trying to get onto the baseball team at a local high school. And he was about 20 pounds overweight, and so his coach came to him and said, "Look, you need to try to lose some weight over the summer." And he says, "And keep practicing with your arm, and then we'll see you at the end of the summer and see how your arm looks and how your weight does and everything, and then we'll do fine." Well, the kid starts exercising throughout the summer, and he's sweating up a storm, and his mother goes out and dutifully buys him Gatorade. Well, he likes the citrus-flavored Gatorade, which turns out to have a tremendous amount of bromide in it, in the sense of brominated vegetable oil. By the beginning of the school year, the kid comes in for his sports physical, and his mother comes up to me and says, "You know, there's something wrong with my child." And I say, "What's wrong?" And she says, "Well, he wants to be withdrawn. He doesn't want to be with the girls. He doesn't want to participate in school events. And he thinks that everybody's against him and that they don't want to have anything to do with him. He's complaining of belly pain. He has a decrease in appetite. He's becoming anorexic. He's having problems with bad breath. And he's constantly complaining of stomach pain. And he seems to be complaining of problems with chest pain." Well, you know, we looked into that, and I sat there and said, "You know, it sounds like your son's developing some type of psychosis of some sort, you know." And then I asked him about what was his favorite Gatorade drink to drink, and he told me. And it turns out that this stuff was loaded with bromide. And I showed it to him, and I said, "Look, you know, what's happened to you is that you've been drinking almost a gallon of this stuff on a daily basis because you were, quote, trying to lose weight. In the meantime, you have soaked your body with bromide, and the bromide is now starting to affect your mind and how it works." Well, once he saw that, and once we put him on iodine to help get rid of the bromide, and also put him on salt, we were able to turn him around, and within a few weeks, he was back into his normal self again.
And I think what's really so interesting is that the iodine really will tend to get rid of the fluoride and get rid of the bromide and really some of the other heavy metals.
You got it. In fact, my son was one of the original research subjects that we used to test iodine with. And he would urinate into this container that would contain all the urine for a whole day. At the end of the day, when the urine was sitting there in the refrigerator in this container, we noticed that there was about a half an inch of thick brown sludge at the bottom of the container. And I sat there and said, "What in the world is this stuff that's in there?" He said, "I don't know that." He said, "It's just coming out of me." And so we did testing with Dr. Abraham, and I said, "What is this brown sludge?" And it turns out it was bromide. And I sat there and said, "Where in the world are you getting bromide from?" And his mother looked at me and said, "I don't know. I never cook with bromide. I don't know where this stuff is coming from." So I told him, I sat there and said, "Where do you eat? What do you do?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I'd like to eat a lot at Taco Bell." So we went over to Taco Bell, looked at the different foods that they were presenting, and nothing really struck out, was outstanding as far as being something loaded with bromide. So I said, well, which one of the soda drinks do you like to drink? And he sat there and said, oh, I love to drink Mountain Dew. And he said, I always get the big container. And it turns out that he was picking up a tremendous amount of Mountain, you know, bromide from his Mountain Dew at Taco Bell. Now, here's the interesting part. I said, how much, you know, Mountain Dew do they serve at the school? You know, in the commons area, they have vending machines. And so I sat there and said, how many of the vending machines do you guys have in the commons area? And he said, well, we have about 12. And I said, and of the 12 vending machines, how many dispense Mountain Dew? And he said, oh, that's easy. He said, 10 of them. He said, the other two dispense Coke and 7-Up and milk and water and so on and so on. But he said, 10 out of the 12 machines are every morning loaded with fresh Mountain Dew from, you know, that we picked, you know, that was loaded in throughout the night. And he said, those vending machines by the end of the day are just virtually empty. And here in the South, our teenage boys are ages 9 through about age 15 are drinking an average of 5 Mountain Dews a day. I mean, I could not believe how extensive the intake of bromide is. And probably the most interesting thing is that if you were to take bromide and put it into, let's say, liquid oil, like let's say olive oil, and you start stirring the bromide into the liquid oil, the bromide will slowly turn that liquid oil into a solid oil, and then it's very solid and you can barely do anything with it. Imagine, you know, years and years and years of drinking these soda drinks that are loaded with brominated vegetable oil, and the kids that were in the problem that we have today called morbid obesity. And we've got kids that are becoming obese nationwide, and they're having, and then they sit there and try to exercise and limit their diet and this and that and so on, and they can't get rid of the fat. And part of the problem is that those of us in the field of public health are starting to sense that part of the problem of not being able to get rid of the fat is the fact that the body fat is becoming solidified by the presence of the tremendous amount of bromide coming in through the soda drinks.
Do you know what they use for sweetener in the Mountain Dew? Do they use sugar? Do they use aspartame? NutraSweet.
Well, they use aspartame, and they also use sugar. Now, bromide. Mountain Dew is loaded with this brominated vegetable oil, but bromide also is a central nervous system depressant. It depresses the central nervous system, also gives you the psychosis problem, and because of that depression issue, what they do is that they take Mountain Dew and they load it with a tremendous amount of caffeine. There's more caffeine in Mountain Dew than there is in Coke. And so here we are, we're making a bunch of jittery, irritable, anxious kids who are having problems with increasing weight, and they don't know where the weight's coming from. We do know that if you were to just take away the soda drinks of the average teenager in North America, that in 1 year these kids will lose somewhere between 10 and 20 pounds in 1 year just by taking them off of soda.
Well, I can certainly believe that, and I think that really there's so much relationship between nutrition and behavior that the average individual has no idea about. But you go right ahead.
Yeah, I think the other problem is you look at, from a public health standpoint, you look at the news of what's going on over the last, probably 10 years, and what we're seeing is that we see young people in the high school systems that are becoming so paranoid because of this or because of that, that they're going around picking up guns and trying to shoot each other, shooting their peers, shooting their parents, shooting their teachers. I mean, and then we think that we need to just throw more counselors out there to try to help these kids out. And it may be that that needs to be done, but I'll tell you one thing. I think we need to take away these soda drinks loaded with brominated vegetable oil out of the school system and try to teach these kids that we need to get this stuff out of the American diet. In fact, I just went and let me put it this way. A few years ago, I was baking some bread, and I was shopping with my wife, and we noticed that when you went down to the grocery store that they were selling brominated flour. They've been putting a lot of bromide into the flour, and that's another way for people to get bromide. And what's interesting is that I went to Brazil just 2 months ago, and I was giving this lecture about bromide and iodine down there, and the doctors that were there said, well, you know, something that's interesting is, as they said, in the year 2000, the Brazilian government outlawed the use of bromide in any of the flour products in Brazil.
I guess they're smarter in Brazil than our people up here.
I'm telling you, it's incredible. Now, there is a, I was doing research on this, and there is, where does the bromide come from? And it turns out that a large percentage of the bromide being used in the United States comes out of the Dead Sea, like the Dead Sea Scrolls out of the Palestine area. They've been out there harvesting bromide out of the Dead Sea, and then they turn around and sell it here to the United States. Now, we've been using bromide to spray strawberries and to spray fruit. So you're living there in California, you probably already know that they've been spraying a lot of your fruit and berries with bromide to, quote, kill the bugs.
So actually, what they do here and where we are, it's very, very close to the strawberry growing area, they actually inject it into the soil as well. Because it kills everything in the soil, and that way there are certain funguses and things that don't grow on the strawberry plants. So we grow the most beautiful strawberries, but now that you've mentioned this, I sort of wonder how much bromide is there in those strawberries, or maybe the strawberry plants are smart enough not to pick it up.
I have no idea, but I can tell you that there's problems there. And then I've heard recently that the state of California was thinking about allowing the companies to start spraying the fruits and vegetables with fluoride in an effort to try to get rid of the fluoride that's developed, that's stockpiling nationwide.
Well, I know that they do actually use it. Fluoride as a pesticide. It's a very, very good pesticide, very good insecticide. I mean, it kills the insects on contact, and that's another reason they're putting it in our drinking water.
Yeah. Well, I just kind of have to worry about the concept that, of us giving, we have mothers who are very deficient in in iodine, and then we give these mothers fluoridated water, and what type of generation are we creating for the future?
Well, I will tell you that
I've talked to a lot of teachers nationwide who have told me that over the last few years they've seen an increasing amount of children who are just having a very difficult time being able to concentrate, and that it seems like we're creating a generation of imbeciles.
Well, I'll tell you, in China they found out that in areas where the water is fluoridated, that there are no geniuses. There are a lot of children, though, with subnormal intelligence, and the incidence of subnormal intelligence increases dramatically in areas with fluoridated water, and you have to ask yourself, why would they be doing that to our children?
That's right, unless we're creating, and especially here in North America. It's interesting that if you go down to Walmart and you go to Walmart and look at the, quote, reverse osmosis or distilled water jugs, and where they sell the distilled water, look up to the right or to the left, and you will see distilled water for children with added fluoride.
And, of course, that then will compete with the iodine as far as getting into the thyroid and producing, a relative hypothyroidism. And why would they be doing that? Certainly the scientific facts behind this are well known, and yet the average doctor doesn't know it, and
That's
the
right.
average dentist doesn't know it.
That's right. And so this is, there seems to be some type of program, something somewhere nationwide that is pushing this bromide issue, pushing the fluoride issue, And as a result, I think our next generation of human beings that we're creating here in North America are going to be people with lower IQs than what we see today.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. George Fleckus, and he's going to be with us for the second hour. Do you have a website you'd like to get out?
Yeah, I have a website. It's called HelpMyThyroid.com.
HelpMyThyroid.com. Okay, anything else? Email or anything else you'd like to get?
If people want to talk to me, they can. My email address is there, and so
hold that thought right there. All right, you've got 3 minutes here to wrap up this hour, and then we'll take I get to talk for about 3 minutes, and then we go to a break, and then we'll be back for the second hour. So let's. You have 3 minutes to sort of wrap up your thoughts on what we've talked about for the first hour.
Well, I think the main thing is that American policy for the government has been set in the sense that we are giving enough iodine to the population to try to inhibit the development of hypothyroidism or even goiter. And the problem is that the average American eats 138 micrograms of iodine per day when the body you can utilize up to 9 or 10 milligrams of iodine a day.
Well, now, my understanding is that the Japanese are taking about 12.5 milligrams, and
right.
They have a much lower incidence of breast carcinoma and prostate cancer.
Got it. In fact, at the next hour, we need to talk about the relationship between iodine deficiency and cancer. I mean, this is a hot issue because cancer has now surpassed heart disease as the number one killer in North America.
And, of course, you know, today, it's estimated that 1 in 3 American men will develop a prostate cancer, 1 in 8, 1 in 7 women will have a breast cancer. And the question is, why are these things increasing so rapidly here in the United States when in countries like Japan, where they have a large consumption of iodine in their diet, they just don't see the high incidence of breast carcinoma. They don't see the high incidence of prostate cancer. And as Dr. Fleckus will tell you in the next hour, if you do get a prostate cancer and it even spreads in your body, it becomes metastatic, but it doesn't kill you. And the question is, does iodine protect the body? And if it does protect the body, why are they taking it out of our bread? Why are they taking it out of our milk? Why are they taking it out of our salt? Go ahead.
Well, it turns out that, in Japan, Japanese men do develop prostate cancer. But what's interesting is that in Japan, men do not die of prostate cancer. The cancer may develop inside the tissue. It does not metastasize. It does not spread. So Japanese men die of old age with their prostate cancer, but the cancer is not what kills them. Whereas here in the United States, approximately, I think it's close to about 40% of men who develop prostate cancer will die with metastatic prostate cancer because the cancer spread and killed them.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I certainly hope you've enjoyed this first hour of our program. And if you, of course, would like to get the full program, remember when we do go to the breaks, we do talk through those periods. And so there's so much more information. If you'd be interested in getting the complete tape of this hour's program, it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And we will be doing a second hour with Dr. Fleckus tonight as well. In fact, we hope to put together a 4-tape set so that you can really analyze this whole situation of iodine. And I'll have to admit that I had heard this, maybe a couple of years ago, and I said to myself, this can't really be a problem, you know, because if there were, I would have heard of it before. Of course, you never want to be egotistical because sometimes you find out you're never quite as smart as you think you were. When I heard the talk given again recently, then I began checking with people who do a lot of time and a lot of research and the people I know I can depend on. And they have verified literally everything that Dr. Fleckus has said in the tapes of his that I have heard. So this is a very real problem. You're going to have to learn a lot more about this, and you're going to have to start preparing to look after your own health, because unfortunately, for one reason or another, they're intensely taking the iodine out of the products that were there that had kept us fairly healthy until just recently. So, and then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get some of the items we do carry dealing with health. I think our book we carry by Dr. Russell Blaylock, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, is vitally important. That's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life is a book that I know my wife refers to frequently, and it simply goes into all the things, whether we're talking about fluoride, whether we're talking about aspartame, whether we're talking about vaccinations or mercury, and all the scientific studies are there, and if you want to check them out, why, you can simply pull many of these down off the computer. So we recommend Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. We have books on the statin drugs and why you should not be taking statin drugs, even though your doctor is going to tell you you're going to die if you don't take them, but you're going to die if you do, because we're all going to die. The question is, are there any statistics that show that they significantly cut back on death from heart disease? And there are none. That's the tragedy. But you certainly can see your levels of cholesterol go down. What's the relationship between low cholesterol and heart disease? Well, you want to get the book on statin drugs, the four tapes on statin drugs. You need to begin to challenge what most people believe, because there's increasing illness in our people. We have much higher levels of heart disease and cancer than comparable groups in other nations, and you have to ask yourself, why, with all the money we spend on public health, why so many of the things are going on in America that are not taking place in other countries? Well, then, of course, we do hope that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. If you do have fluoridated water in your area, there is a way of getting it out. Certainly, you'd certainly want to get a special shower head so you wouldn't be bathing in fluoridated water. There we have the Berkey water filters, which we think are excellent. And my wife and I use one here in our own home. We think it is beneficial, and if you're interested in knowing more, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com, but you should not be drinking fluoridated water. If you want to know the truth about fluoridated water and what the scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency say about fluoridated water, you should go to the website of the Union of the engineers, scientists, and lawyers who work for the EPA, who are trying to tell the American people they're being poisoned. Their website is NTEU280.org. www.NTEU280.org stands for National Treasury Employees Union 280. They're frantically trying to tell the American people. They're writing letters to the editors across America saying, stop the water fluoridation, you're poisoning the American people. And not one in a thousand Americans have ever heard what the people who work for the EPA is saying. You only hear what the bureaucrats are saying, and they're saying why water fluoridation is safe and efficient. And we're just going to continue this right along as we see the intelligence of our children fading away like yesterday's sunset. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming in from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and of course we ordinarily would welcome your calls from out across America, but let's just go for a while, and please don't call in unless I specifically ask for calls. Our guest this evening, Dr. George Fletcher, who practices in North Carolina, family doctor, who became fascinated with this problem of iodine deficiency and noted a very direct causal relationship between fibrocystic disease in women and iodine deficiency. Noted the statistics showed that how dramatically incidence of breast cancer was increasing in America, and also many of the physical conditions that are directly related to iodine deficiencies. And the average individual honestly believes that all of your salt they buy at the grocery store is fluoridated, and it really isn't. Well, before we go on the rest of the program, Dr. Fletcher, somebody had called in and asked two questions. Does the lack of thyroid have anything to do with polycystic kidney disease?
You're talking about lack of iodine?
Yes,
We don't know. I don't know if anybody has published in that area.
All
we
right.
We do know that for people, I think, above age 40 or 50, that approximately 50% of us in the population have problems with cysts in the kidneys. Now, I will tell you that there is increased evidence to suggest that the problem of increased cyst throughout the whole body, whether we talk, and if you were to just type in the word cyst of breast and cyst of thyroid and then type in cyst of, like, you can go to the National Library of Medicine website, PubMed, just type in these things. You will see that that there is a relationship between the development of cysts in the thyroid, cysts in the breast, and cysts of the ovaries, and cysts of the brain, and cysts of the liver, and cysts of other tissues. And it turns out that we have found that there is a tremendous number of tissues throughout the body that are very iodine-dependent for normal function. In fact, let me just... what was the second question?
Well, the second one was, does long-term use of thyroxine lead to hyperthyroidism?
Long-term use of thyroid hormones,
yes,
does not lead to hyperthyroidism.
All right, no. I wouldn't think so. But somebody had asked the question. I figured we'd come to you for the answer to that. Okay, well, you just go right ahead then with your discussion of the things that you'd like to bring up during this hour.
Well, what we have discovered is that iodine deficiency in the thyroid, it's the absence of iodine in the cells that is a promoter of cancer. Therefore, a person who develops a goiter has a higher rate of thyroid cancer. In fact, in the last 10 years here in North America, the rate of thyroid cancer has doubled within the last 10 years. And a lot of it is associated with the fact that we've deprived the population of iodine. The other thing that we've seen is that the absence of iodine in the thyroid, you get what's called hyperplasia. That is, you see there's an increase in cellular rate of division and multiplication, and the more hyperplasia you have in cells, the more problems with potential development of cancer. And the same thing is true in the breast. With the absence of iodine in the breast tissue, you see hyperplasia. And hyperplasia is just one step away from development of breast cancer.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest this evening. All right. You were just saying that, of course, that with the absence of iodine, we get hyperplasia. And hyperplasia is just a step away from the development of cancer. So go right ahead.
among the gynecologists, the GYN endocrinology doctors, they have known for years that women who have problems with polycystic ovaries have problems with increased ovarian cancer by the time they get into the 40s and 50s. And in fact, many of these doctors recommend to women with polycystic ovaries that they have their ovaries removed by the time they're in their 40s and 50s because of the high incidence of ovarian cancer. And so, now I'll give you another one, and that is that about 20% of all the iodine in the human body sits inside the skin. And we have tried to identify what is it that iodine is doing in the skin. It turns out that iodine is what helps the body to sweat. So you'll have people who will get out there and exercise, like here in the South. I mean, it gets hot and muggy in the winter, in the summer, and I have patients who will come in and sit there and say, I can get hot, but I never sweat. I don't break a sweat at all. And I was down in Puerto Rico about 2 years ago, and a professor of pharmacology came up to me after I made that statement. He said, let me give you an interesting story. He said about 5 years ago, about the year 2000, he said, my mother came up to me and said, Mom, she came up to him and said, son, she said, I've lost my ability to sweat. And he looked at his mother and he said, well, mother, that is wonderful. You don't, now you won't have to be stinky. And she sat there and said, wrong statement. She said, I have lived on this island of Puerto Rico for 70 years. She said, it gets up to 90 degrees out here. It's 100% humidity. And don't tell me it's normal for somebody not to sweat on this island. And her son, the pharmacologist and the guru at the medical school, sat there and said, you know, Mom, it's okay. You don't need to sweat because, you know, and then you don't have to be stinky. And she said, son, it's not normal, you know. And so every year after that, at her birthday, she, you know, he'd go over there and she'd look at him and say, son, have you figured out why I can't sweat? And he'd sit there and say, Mom, it's okay. It's, you don't need to sweat, you know. And then at the time I had met the gentleman, which was about 2 years ago, it was in August, he told me that the previous December his mother was diagnosed with having metastatic breast cancer and that he had just buried his mother like 30 days prior to the medical meeting.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. George Fletcher. He was just telling the story of a pharmacologist who had a mother lived in one of the Caribbean islands, and she was unable to perspire, and she was worried for a number of years why she couldn't perspire, and her son kept telling her there was nothing to worry about, and then she developed metastatic breast cancer, and she died, and so please go on with the story there.
Well, it turns out that if you were to go to a place like Japan, now in Japan, the average Japanese eats about 13.8 milligrams of iodine per day. In the United States, it's 138 micrograms. In essence, the Japanese are eating almost 100 times more iodine per day than we are. And yet, you know, you think about it, in Japan, they have, as a nation, the Japanese have one of the least amounts of cancers of all the world. Now, think about it. We have nuked those people over there twice. Their land, land is loaded with radioactive material, and yet they have the least amount of cancers of the whole world. I mean, you go over there to Chernobyl, where there was that tremendous release of radiation, and I take care of Russians here in the Asheville area, and they tell me that back in the Ukraine, there is a tremendous amount of cancer developing all over the area from people that were exposed to the radiation from Chernobyl. Yet, look at the Japanese eating this high dosage of iodine, and they get their iodine basically from seaweed. And yet they have one of the least amounts of breast cancer, least amounts of gynecological cancer. They don't, you know, they have the least amounts of ovarian and uterine cancers and so on. Now, it's interesting that in the United States, we've concentrated so much on trying to help people to lower their cholesterol. let's not eat lots of red meat, and let's not eat lots of pork, and let's try to eat more white meats, and so on and so on, and let's get rid of the butter, and so on and so on and so on. But you know what's interesting is we have deprived, we've been teaching our population how to become vegetarians. What we haven't taught our population to do is how to become good marine vegetarians. We haven't taught them how to eat seaweed. There's a good 20 or 30 seaweeds that are very edible, that have different flavors, and the Japanese eat seaweed 3 times a day. I mean, they eat this stuff for breakfast, they eat it in their gummy bears, they eat it in everything, but they have seaweed galore. And because of that, then the Japanese virtually have very few cancers. They do have a lot of stomach cancer, but we feel that that's because they eat so many cold cuts with the nitrosamines in there. But the other types of cancers, it's just rarely ever seen in Japan. Now, Dr. Abraham and I and others have published articles on the subject of iodine, and you can download these for free from our website, helpmythyroid.com. You'll see a picture of me there, and then you can also look at the section on the iodine research articles, and you can download this stuff from there. One of the things that we discovered is that in working with iodine is that iodine helps to chelate out heavy metals. We had a neurosurgeon who was working with us early on in the research program, and he was donating some urine for us for some studies. And we noticed on the original studies that he had a level of arsenic that was about 5. Started to get him on iodine, and within a period of a month, the arsenic level in his urine went from 5 up to 390, when normal was up to about 8 or 9. And basically, we've seen the same thing true with mercury, lead, aluminum, a lot of the heavy metals.
How about iron? Does it take up the iron too?
No, it doesn't chelate iron. But and it's interesting that when you look at iodine, and we've done this with the essential metals versus the heavy metals, the ones that are toxic to the human body, that iodine will get rid of the really bad stuff, that the heavy metals that get into our systems, but all the essential metals that are there and minerals, they're left alone. Their levels do not drop. So it is being very selective as far as helping us to be able to hang on to the right set of minerals and getting rid of the stuff that's really toxic inside of our bodies. Now, having gone to that point, it turns out that the human body has got these little canals at the level of the cells, the muscle cells, the breast cells, the thyroid cells, and these little canals are selective for transporting iodine into the cell. And this system is known as the sodium iodide synporter. And it turns out that bromide and fluoride poisons the ability of the synporter to work properly. And as a result, then you end up with poor absorption at the cellular level of iodine. Now, in the process of working with patients, we have found people who have problems with cancer and other things, and when we check them out, we find that their synporters aren't working. That is, the body cannot concentrate iodine into the cells, and in fact, if you give somebody 50 milligrams of iodine, they urinate out 50 milligrams. Basically, they didn't absorb even 1 milligram of this stuff. It all went back out. And basically that says that the cells are starving for iodine because they can't absorb it. Well, we have found that one way to help increase absorption of iodine is with the use of vitamin C. And we use ester vitamin C or buffered vitamin C, 1,500 milligrams 2 times a day. So anybody who wants to incorporate iodine into their supplement program should also be using vitamin C. Now, another thing that's interesting, and this is research that I've recently been reading, and that is that when you take iodine, iodine goes into the cells of the body, kicks bromide out of the cells, and the level of bromide in the bloodstream goes up. The bromide goes to the kidney where chloride, like from salt, chloride pushes the bromide into the urine and gets rid of it. And so it's in, you know, for people who don't have hypertension and they've got the possibility of maybe taking in a tremendous amount of bromide, it would be good for them to take like 1 teaspoon of Celtic sea salt, about 1 teaspoon of this per day, and they can spread it out throughout the whole day. But the chloride in the salt helps them to move the bromide out of the body. And in fact, if you urinate and then just look at the, you know, let the urine sit there for a while, you'll see the sediment that develops towards the bottom of the toilet. And it's because of the bromide that gets kicked out of the body. For people with hypertension, they can use, they can go down to the health food store and buy potassium chloride. And again, it's, the main issue here is you've got to get chloride to help mobilize the bromide out of the body. The other thing that we have seen is that, you know, the big question that arises is, okay, so the absence of iodine gives you problems with fibrocystic breast disease. Can taking iodine reverse the illness? And the answer is yes. In fact, in the north, well, in the Northeast, we had problems with goiter. In fact, in Akron, Ohio, 56% of the people in Akron in 1924 had problems with goiter. And by giving them iodine, and back in those days, we were giving patients with goiter between 50 and 150 milligrams of iodine per day. And we watched the goiters disappear, shrink, and go down. Well, the question arises, if you got fibrocystic breast disease with these really tender tissues, can you reverse the illness? And the answer is yes. You can take a woman with this problem and give her 50 milligrams a day of iodine, and what ends up happening is that within just a few weeks her breast pain disappears, and within a matter of about 2 or 3 years we see a 50 to 90% reduction in the scar tissue, cysts, and nodules that are present in the breast tissue. So can fibrocystic breast disease or, quote, benign breast changes be reversed by taking iodine? The answer is yes. Now, it's interesting that iodine was first discovered by one of Napoleon's scientists, whose job it was to make saltpeter from seaweed by adding some sulfuric acid. And he saw this violaceous material come out from the bats that he was using. And that they let the French Academy of Science would later be able to identify the fact that this was a new element that had not been seen before. And it was actually one of the first medicines that we in medicine developed that actually cured a disease. I mean, you think about it. Back in the 1800s, we were giving people strychnine, mercury, bismuth. We were taking all sorts of heavy metals to try to cure the disease. A lot of times, the cure would cure the disease, but we would also kill the patient. And in this particular case, this was one of the success stories of the 1800s, and that is we were able to give iodine to get rid of goiter. And we can now talk about the fact that giving iodine does get rid of fibrocystic breast disease, does get rid of problems with polycystic ovaries.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, let's go ahead. You were talking about the problem with polycystic ovaries. Go ahead.
Yeah. And it turns out that for those people who have polycystic ovaries, one of the medical problems that these girls have is a problem of diabetes. And we've treated them with 50 milligrams of iodine. And by the way, the iodine we used was developed in the 1850s, 1840s, right in there, by a guy by the name of Dr. Lugol. And many of you know it as Lugol's solution. And Lugol's is a combination of iodine and the salt of iodine called potassium iodide. And so Lugol's is a combination of both iodine and iodide. And it turns out that there are tissues in the body that have preferences for iodine. And so you will find that the stomach prefers iodine, breast tissue prefers iodine and iodide, the salt. Thyroid tissue prefers the use of strictly iodide. You have tissues like the prostate that are very prefer the iodide, and it just keeps on going. So we find that you need to have both types of iodine, not just iodine, but you also need iodide. To try to say that you need one or the other is incorrect. Now, back to the girls with the polycystic ovaries. We would give them this combination of Lugol solution in a tablet called Iodorol. And in the process of doing so, we noticed that these girls were coming back and telling us that their problems with diabetes got better. And so I had a patient that came in, and she was an overweight lady, probably about 320-pounder, who came in and had abnormal blood sugar. Well, she came in through the emergency room with a blood sugar of 1,380. That's a blood sugar that can kill people. You know, a normal blood sugar shouldn't be above 100. This lady was 1,380. And we put her on insulin, and then we asked her to come back and see me in the office in about 2 weeks. And when she was in the office, I sat there and said, you know, while you were there in the hospital, we put you on insulin, and I noticed that you had fibrocystic breast disease, and so here's some articles showing us that if you take iodine, that helps to calm them down. She said, yeah, these things are so painful just before my periods, and it'd be nice to have some comfort here. So we placed her on the Lugol's or the Iodorol 50 milligram per day, and we also instructed her and taught her how to use a glucometer. She came back. I said, now, if you have any problems, you know, give me a call. She calls up about a week later, and she says, you know, I'm starting to experience problems with hypoglycemia while I'm taking insulin. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, well, why don't you just lower the total amount of insulin so that you don't have hypoglycemia? Well, she comes in a month later to the office, and she has her glucometer with all the blood sugar readings for the last month. We download everything, and her average blood sugar for the whole month was 98.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. Fletcher. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Fletcher was just telling us about this woman who'd come into the emergency room with a blood sugar of about 1,300. Now, with the ordinarily, this is a diabetic crisis, ordinarily blood sugar is 100. He places her on insulin to bring the blood sugar down, but he places her on iodine, probably Iodorol, iodine, and iodide capsules, treat her fibrocystic breast disease. That the certainly she comes in at the end of a month. He has a chance to look at her insulin meter, her blood sugar meter, and he finds out that her average blood sugar is running about 98, which is really quite normal. So pick the rest of the story up there.
Well, I looked at the lady and I said, you know, this is really good. you are exercising really good. She was walking like an hour twice a day. And in fact, exercising muscle does not need insulin to lower blood sugars. Exercising muscle can absorb sugar directly from the bloodstream without the use of insulin. And so she was, but I thought, you know, this woman, she's, you know, 6 weeks ago, she had a blood sugar of 1,380. I mean, that's an incredible number. Anybody who's got that gets put on insulin, period. And so I told her, I said, you know, you're doing so good with your diet, you're doing so good with your exercise program and so on, and you're doing so good with your insulin. And she says, oh, didn't I tell you that I stopped taking insulin 4 weeks ago? I said, wait a minute. I never gave you instructions to stop taking insulin. She said, sure you did. You said that I could keep lowering my blood, my insulin as long as I kept having problems with hypoglycemia. And she sat there and said, I kept having hypoglycemia until I stopped taking insulin. She said, once I came off insulin, my blood sugars have been okay. And I said, let's find out about this. And so she'd been off of insulin for 4 months, for 4 weeks, and had an average sugar of 98. Well, I said, well, this may be just a fluke or who knows what. So I said, let's just keep watching your blood sugars 2 times a day. Stay with your diet and your exercise program. We'll see you back in a month. Brought her back in a month later. Her average blood sugar was 93. She continued to be taking the iodine. And it was at that point that we finally figured out that, you know, that what we had seen with the patients with the polycystic ovaries in the sense of better blood sugar control, we actually had a live diabetic here who was actually much improved and virtually normal in the presence of taking iodine without having to take any more insulin. Well, we did some research, and it turns out that there was an anesthesiologist out of Australia by the name of Dr. Clue who published and showed that the receptors, all hormone receptors in the human body have an amino acid called tyrosine. And tyrosine is what the body attaches iodine to. And it turns out that there is an enzyme in the breast called lactoperoxidase. It's the enzyme that allows for the breast to attach iodine to the milk in the mother. Well, that enzyme turns out that it can go anywhere it wants to in the whole body. And the enzyme has the ability to attach iodine to tyrosine anywhere it finds it in the body. Having said that, what happened is that we have now seen people who have problems with, well, the other thing that I need to say is that every receptor, once iodine attaches to the receptor upregulates its ability to recognize the hormone that's supposed to attach to the receptor. Now, let's look at diabetes. 90% of diabetics have plenty of insulin. They are not insulin deprived. They have insulin. They have what they call insulin resistant diabetes, and that is the receptors for insulin do not recognize the presence of insulin. And it turns out that what the iodine was doing was it was increasing the sensitivity of the receptor for the insulin that was out there. We've seen the same situation for patients with testosterone. Like we've had women who come into the office and have virtually no sex drive. We give them 5, 10, 15, 50, 100 milligrams of testosterone, and finally they have a sex drive. And we've watched these girls carefully over the years, and they didn't develop any problems with hirsutism or any other male developing features, no worsening of their voice or anything, while taking the testosterone. But then all of a sudden, in the presence of, you know, and the average male makes about 100 milligrams of testosterone a day. The average female makes about 2.5 to 5 milligrams of testosterone.
Hold up. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, why don't you go right ahead, Dr. Fletcher?
Well, what ended up happening is that these were patients that had been on high doses of testosterone for probably the last 2 or 3 years and hadn't had any problems with 100 milligrams a day. We started them on the iodine, and within 2 or 3 weeks, all of a sudden these patients came back in and said, my sex drive is driving me crazy. And I sat there and said, wait a minute, you've been on this stuff for years now, and it hasn't done that to you. And they sat there and said, well, it sure is now, you know. And it turns out that it all started again when we placed the patient on iodine. And we've seen this happen with some hormones that control ovarian function called FSH-LH. One of the things that we know about a developed and aging ovary is that the ovary becomes resistant to the stimulation of the ovary with these two hormones. And all of a sudden, with starting to take iodine, we've seen women who stopped having periods at age 38 start having periods again. And, I mean, these were women who had stopped having periods for at least a whole year who started taking iodine, and all of a sudden they started having periods again, and we're talking about every 28 days, and that's still true 5 years later. They're still having periods every 28 days. So, and, you know, it just keeps on going. What we're finding is that iodine has a tremendous amount of benefits to the body. Another one that we discovered is that one of my patients came in, and she was wearing her red dress here in the winter. And she said, well, what do you think about the dress? And I said, well, that looks nice, you know. And she said, what you don't know is, she says, I haven't been able to wear this dress for the last 15 years. And I said, why is that? She said, it's made from wool. And I said, and? And she said, every time I wear wool, she said, I break out in hives and I itch to death. And she said, I started taking iodine, and she said within a period of about 3 or 4 months, and she said, I can now wear a wool dress and I don't itch. Well, there's an amino acid out there in the body called histidine, and histidine is the precursor for making histamine. Now, we take antihistamines to try to control these things from causing us to have runny noses and problems with hives and so on. And it turns out that iodine inhibits the conversion of histidine to histamine.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. And Dr. Fletcher is just saying that iodine sometimes will actually tend to prevent certain allergic reactions. It changes certainly the whole metabolism of the body and makes certain substances, even hormones, work much more efficiently in the individual because it changes the status of the receptors. And so iodine is such an essential element, and seems to be doing everything we can to restrict people's access to it. Go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, another thing that we've seen is that it's not unusual for a patient to be told, you know, the patient comes in and they say, I'm cold, I'm constipated, I'm gaining weight, my skin's dry, I don't feel good. And so the doctor checks them out and says, yep, your thyroid hormones are off balance, your TSH is elevated, your thyroid T4 is down. So then they put them on thyroid hormone, and a few weeks later the patient walks back in and says, I'm taking the thyroid hormone, I'm still constipated, my skin is still dry, my hair is still falling out, and I'm still constipated and I'm not sweating and so on. And the doctor pulls blood, and because he knows that the patient's on thyroid hormone, he comes back and says, well, your thyroid TSH and your thyroid T4 values are normal, so therefore I got you on the right dosage of thyroid hormone. I'm not going to do anything else. And yet the patient still has probably 90% of the symptoms that they walked in with, complaining to the doctor, that gave the doctor the clue that they had possibility of low thyroid disease. And yet, when he rechecks the thyroid hormone values, they're, quote, normal. Well, it turns out that the thyroid receptors, the receptors inside the body are needing iodine, because when you put iodine on the thyroid hormone receptor, the thyroid hormone and the receptor increases its sensitivity to the presence of the hormone, and all of a sudden these symptoms disappear. In fact, we've had patients who have been taking thyroid hormone for years and having constipation, started taking iodine, and within 2 or 3 days, all of a sudden their constipation disappeared. We've had patients who haven't been able to sweat while taking thyroid hormone, but all of a sudden started sweating within a few weeks of starting to take iodine. So iodine helps to, a lot of the symptoms that we blame as far as being due to low thyroid disease, these symptoms are felt to actually be due to the absence of iodine in the body. Again, the thyroid only holds 3% of all the iodine in the body. The thyroid can hold about 50 milligrams of iodine. The total body can hold 1,500 milligrams of iodine. 70% of that 1,500 milligrams sits inside your muscles and in the fat tissues of the body. What's iodine doing in your fat? Actually, you have what you eat, these polyunsaturated fats such as olive oil and almond oil and black walnut oil and so on. And these oils are liquid because they have double bonds of carbons inside the oil. And iodine attaches to those areas and keeps the oils from being oxidized. Actually, iodine is what helps the body to keep its fatty tissues or fats from becoming oxidized until they're utilized by the body, which means that iodine is helping to keep the membranes of the body from being oxidized. And also, iodine is being used like up inside the brain tissue, iodine helps to increase mental activity, mental cognition. Like we said, every hormone in the body is the receptors for those hormones are dependent upon iodine. When the iodine gets attached to the receptor, the body's hormone, the receptors increase their sensitivity to the hormone that's supposed to attach to it. Having said that, think about all the neurohormones that are present inside the brain. And the brain tissue has an active transport mechanism for pumping iodine into brain tissue. It's almost like the same thing, the same transport mechanism for absorbing iodine into the thyroid tissue is active and present in the brain tissue. And iodine helps to increase your sensitivity to the receptors for serotonin, for dopamine, for GABA, all these hormones that are running around governing your day-to-day operations of how you feel and your emotions. And iodine helps to increase the sensitivity. So we're finding people who are coming back and sitting there saying, you know, my depression lifted the day I started taking iodine. Within a few days, I was feeling so much better. I mean, we're seeing people out there who've got problems with their hormones and especially, you know, mental function. And we're finding that iodine helps to improve on that very quickly, and people feel so much better.
Well, now, of course, somebody just called in and talking about young men who are diabetic and taking insulin. Have you seen other people who have been on insulin or already have this insulin-resistant diabetes who are helped by being placed onto iodine so that they can control their blood sugar much more readily with insulin or even get off of it?
Actually, we have seen two things happen. Number one, as you know, 90% of diabetics have insulin-resistant diabetes, which means that if you give iodine to people who have insulin, that they can have better sugar control. Now, we did do a study on 12 patients at the practice, and we found that 50% of the people that we placed on iodine were able to come off all medications for treatment of their diabetes, and that's the oral medications. Now, the other 50%, We were able to get some of them off of one medicine, some of them off of two medicines, some of them off of three. But some patients had to be left on their diet, you know, on their medications when, because they just were such, you know, they had deteriorated so much with their diabetes. Now, I do have 10% of my diabetics have no insulin at all. These people are insulin-dependent diabetics because they don't make it. And so then those people, like I had one of my diabetics, he was on 98 units of Lantus insulin. This is a man that's 61 years old. He's a farmer, and he's taking 98 units of Lantus insulin every evening to help control his blood sugars. We started him on 100 milligrams of iodine per day. He was a large boy. I mean, he came in weighing 290 pounds. We started him on that, and within a matter of a few months, he was down to 28 units of insulin in order to control his blood sugars. Whereas before, it was taking 98 units to control his sugars. A few months later, it's down to not 28 units. So, yes, we are able to reduce the total amount of insulin that insulin-dependent diabetics use, and they don't have to use as much of it.
Now, what about heart disease? You know, we've heard some stories about certainly the relationship between iodine deficiency and heart disease.
Well, you know, we don't have enough evidence on that one right now, but what we do have evidence for is a problem called cardiac arrhythmias. And that is that there's a medication out there called amiodarone. It's a organic iodine that people take, and this stuff releases about 9 milligrams of iodine into the bloodstream on a continuous basis, on a daily basis, especially once the body gets saturated with amiodarone. What's interesting is that the amiodarone is being used for ventricular tachycardia and ventricular arrhythmia problems, and that when you take this stuff, it helps to calm down the heart, and especially these abnormal heartbeats. Once we started giving patients iodorol, which we found that the iodorol was doing the same thing, that people with atrial fib and ventricular tachycardia and problems with their abnormal heartbeats, their hearts calm down, and they do much, much better as far as controlling their abnormal heartbeats. And it turns out the problem is that amiodarone is a very toxic substance to the human body. And it turns out that the medication is causing pulmonary fibrosis, it's causing cirrhosis of the liver, it's got all sorts of side effects. And then people are out there sitting there saying, well, the reason that these side effects are there is because this is such a high dose of iodine. And it turns out that we have to distinguish between what's called organic iodine versus elemental iodine. Elemental iodine is what you put in salt. Like when you have iodized salt, that is elemental iodine. Organic iodine is an iodine that is bound to a protein or bound to some other substance. And illustrations of that would be something like IBP dye. There's a lot of cough syrups where they add the iodine to another chemical to use it as a cough syrup. Another illustration, we use in the pulmonary industry, we use SSKI, supersaturated potassium iodide. Now that's elemental iodine. And you know, you're going to get doctors and you're going to get endocrinologists and other doctors who will sit there and say the following. You know, you're taking 50 milligrams of iodine. You know, that's a really toxic dose. And yet these doctors will not blink an eye when you use this product called SSKI, which we use all the time for patients with emphysema and asthma. And how much do we use? 300 to 500 milligrams a day to treat these lung problems, and the doctors don't blink one iota on that, and yet they're gonna, and they start getting shaky if you tell them that you're taking 50 milligrams of iodine a day, when in their own medical practices they're using these super high doses of SSKI.
Well, now, of course, ordinarily, what would the dose be for somebody that you had came in that you thought might be iodine deficient, or should just people ordinarily be on an iodine supplement, you think?
You know, the guy who gave us this information was a guy by the name of Dr. St. Georgi. He was a Hungarian doctor who was an iodine expert. Dr. St. Georgi was the guy who discovered vitamin C, and he's the man who trained Linus Pauling into the use of mega doses or high doses of vitamin C. But it turns out that Dr. St. Georgi, before he became famous with vitamin C, was actually an iodine researcher. And back in the 1950s, he gave some lectures here in North America. And I'm going to give you a quote. He sat there and said, "Based upon research by iodine researchers worldwide, between 1850 and the 1950s, over the last 100 years, he said, our conclusion is that the average human needs about 62 milligrams of iodine per day. You know, and this was from empirical evidence that had been done back all those years. You know, doctors just found that if you gave 62 milligrams of iodine a day to the average human being, they would do so much better. They don't get sick. They don't get cancers. They don't have all sorts of medical problems that the rest of the populations do. And so we feel that if you were to look at people in general, we would support the idea of using like 50 milligrams of Lugol solution on a daily basis, whether it be Iodorol or just plain Lugol, and using buffered vitamin C or ester vitamin C, 1,500 milligrams two times a day. And if there's problems with bromide, where there might be a lot of bromide from eating too much bread or from drinking a lot of soda drinks or Gatorade products with bromide, that a person take approximately one teaspoon of Celtic sea salt or potassium chloride. They need the chloride to pump the bromide out so that the bromide isn't competing with the iodine to get into the tissues of the body.
All right, so now what about somebody comes in, they've just got, you know, they're constipated, dry skin, they just feel cold all the time, their hands are cold. I mean, would they just benefit from iodine? Should they go ahead and have the thyroid? Is there any times that you can get people off the thyroid, just put them onto iodine?
Actually, what we've done is we put people on thyroid, you know, they're on thyroid hormone. Let's say you walked in and you were on thyroid hormone. We put you on the iodine, and then what happens is about 3 or 4 weeks later, it could even be 2 or 3 months later, the person starts developing symptoms of hyperthyroidism, nervousness, insomnia, sweating in the palms, you know, just very oily skin, et cetera, et cetera. And at that point, what we do is we take their thyroid hormone and we cut it in half. So, but you don't do the cutting in half until they start experiencing symptoms of hyperthyroidism. And what's going on? The body's thyroid hormone receptors have increased their sensitivity to the presence of the thyroid hormone that's present. There's an increased sensitivity, so therefore you cut back on the use of thyroid hormone. I used to be hypothyroid myself, and it took me about a year to come off of thyroid hormone because of my symptoms that I started developing. And today, I personally take about 50 milligrams of Lugol's or Iodorol on a daily basis. My thyroid T4 is like 7.8, my TSH is 2.1, and my free T3 blood level is like 3.5. Now, again, it just shows us that taking iodine does not cause a lot of medical problems. I would recommend that people go to my website and they can download a article called The Wolf Chekhov Effect, Crying Wolf. And in that particular article, we show that a lot of the concerns that the medical community has about why we shouldn't use these high doses of iodine were based upon some articles that were absolutely faulty when they were written back in the 1940s.
And let's get that website just one more time.
Now, the website is called helpmythyroid.com, and you can go to the iodine tab on the top and go towards the bottom of that. Once you activate the tab towards the bottom, you'll see all the articles that have been published, and you can download these for free.
Okay, helpmythyroid.com. Our guest has been Dr. George Fletcher, and we'll be wrapping up the program here in just a moment. Well, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program now. It's been a real pleasure having you with us. I want you to know how much I've enjoyed the program here, and I've certainly learned a lot. But please go ahead and give your parting thoughts for our listeners.
Well, all I can tell you is that we need to, a lot of times physicians will tell us things, but a lot of times we are, as individuals, are responsible for our own health. And a lot of times we're going to have to research out things to make sure that the right set of information was transferred down to the doctors. And in this particular case, this issue about iodine has had a problem where physicians either are not informed about the effects of lack of iodine in the body, and if you say iodine to a doctor, he most often thinks thyroid. He doesn't think breast. He doesn't think ovaries. He doesn't think skin. He doesn't think about the receptors that are present. He doesn't think about the relationship of iodine and allergies. And it's been known for years that people who were low thyroid, hypothyroid, have a higher rate of problems with allergies. And yet we didn't know, you know, what it is. What is it about hypothyroidism that's causing problems with increasing allergy? So there's a lot out there that needs to be studied out. But all I beg of people to do is go back, read the articles that we publish. We put literally hundreds of hours into, you know, studying these subjects out. We've done the best thing to make it easy for people to understand these articles. Read them and be convinced for yourself.
All right, fine. And certainly you can find these articles up on, is it Help My Thyroid?
That's right, helpmythyroid.com.
Helpmythyroid.com. All right, fine. And so if people were starting out, should they start out with, say, with a low dose? What about the possibility of sensitivity to iodine? Is anybody sensitive to iodine?
If a person can take iodized salt, then they can take the Lugol's or the Iodorol that we've been talking about. If they sit there and say, when I take salt that has iodine in it and I break out with hives, then that person has to avoid iodine with the, like the plague, because there's dying over, you know, taking iodine.
How frequently would that happen?
That actually happens in about less than one half of 1% of the population.
All right, so there's certain people have the same reaction to fluoride. They just can't take fluoride. They can't drink fluoridated water.
But, you know, we have found that the vast majority of the population can take iodine. They can do well. I'm the medical director of a medical lab where we
hold
do
that thought
iodine
for just
testing.
Well, Dr. Fletcher was just saying he's the medical director of a medical lab. Go right ahead. What was that?
Yeah, we actually can measure the amount of iodine in the body, not measuring just thyroid hormone. We actually can measure how sufficient is the body with iodine. So we do have a test that we can offer to do that to the population at large to help them figure out if they are iodine deficient. If so, then let's get them on the appropriate treatment. And also, we repeat the testing a few months later to demonstrate that the concentration of iodine in the body is going up. There are some people out there where the concentration does not go up, and it requires special help by myself and other doctors to try to figure out why they're not absorbing the iodine like they should.
All right, well, we're out of time, but God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's been fascinating.
Welcome.
I hope we can get you onto our other programs as well. I'd like all of our audiences to hear your story.
No problem.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
All right, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our program this evening with Dr. Fletcher. And certainly if you'd like to know more about Iodorol, why, we will be carrying that through Radio Liberty, and we're going to start taking it ourselves. We think it's a great... As we've checked this out with our other experts, we are iodine deficient. Why are they putting fluoride into our water? Fluoride is definitely toxic and, of course, competes for getting into the thyroid gland. And this is one reason I'm convinced firmly that so many people in America are on armor thyroid pills, and they're taking a thyroid because, of course, we're fluoridating the water, we're suppressing the iodine, its ability to get in. Anyway, there's lots of things you have to learn about your health, and this is just one more thing that I think is very, very important. And the idea that actually the iodine can increase the sensitivity of cells to the hormones and the other products. Fascinating material. If you'd like to get the 2-hour set of the interview we did with Dr. Fletcher tonight, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We've done an interview with Dr. Blaylock, and we'll be doing another one with Dr. Donald Miller, who's a cardiac professor of cardiac surgery at the University of Washington. He's done a lot of work on this, and they all agree, and certainly we've checked this with our good friend Bill Sardi, and he confirms most of what you've heard this evening. Under any circumstances, you really need to learn more about your health and what you need to maintain your health. Let me suggest the book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. The Miracle of Magnesium. The book on statin drugs, or the 4-tape set on statin drugs. So much information on health is available from Radio Liberty. If you'd like to go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, you can scroll down and look at the books we have. Or if you'd like to get a health catalog which lists the books we have that deal with health and health issues, plus the various products we carry. We do carry the Berkey water products, be it the Big Berkey, Berkey Light, shower filters, or sport small bottles that will filter water, although the sport bottle doesn't take the fluoride out, but we can get the fluoride out with the Big Berkey or the Berkey Light or the shower filter. If you'd like to know more about that, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Why are these things happening? Well, there's a plan. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. If you have not yet heard my talk on the hidden agenda, or seen the syllabus with all the scientific studies there, as we talk about the use of fluoride to poison the American people and to destroy the minds and intelligence of our children, why, I suggest you call us at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the talk on, it's a video on the hidden agenda and or the syllabus. We suggest you get them together. Ask for the DVDs, Let the Truth Be Told. Is Your Drinking Water Safe? And there's one other DVD on the drinking water, adding fluoride to drinking water. You must understand they're poisoning the American people. Pray for America. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.